Nanda ki jai. Namacharya Srila Haridasa Thakur ki jai. Prem Shri Gaur Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhar Shri Vasadi Gaur Bhakta Vrinda ki jai. Shri Shri Radha Krishna Gaur Gopinath Shri Mukunda Radha Kunda Giri Govardhana ki jai. Vrindavan Dhamma ki jai. Mathura Dhamma ki jai. Navadvipa Mayapur Dhamma ki jai. Jagannath Puri Dhamma ki jai. Gangamaya Jamuna Devi ki jai. Bhakti Devi ki jai. Tulsi Maharani ki jai. Samaveta Bhakta Vrinda ki jai. Gaur Premananda. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Sri Guru and Gauranga. All glories to Srila Prabhupada Nama Om Vishnu Padaya. Krishna Prasthaya Bhutale Srimati Bhakti Vedanta Swami Niti Namane Namaste Sarasvati Deve Gauravani Pacharane Nirase Sisanivadi Paskatyade Satarne Vandeham Sri Guru Sri Uta Padakamalam Sri Guru and Vaishnavam Scha Sri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Raghunatham Vitam Stam Sajivam Sadvaitam Sadvadutam Parijana Sahita Krishna Chaitanya Devam Sri Radha Krishna Padam Sahagana Lalita Sri Vishakam Vitam Scha Panchakalpati Vischa Kipasanavyavata Patitanam Pavanavyo Vaishnavya Namaha Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. April 24th, 2019 in Denver, Colorado, and we're reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 3, Chapter 26, Fundamental Principles of Material Nature, Text 30. Samshayota viparyaso
Samshayota viparyaso
Nischaya smritirevacha Swapayachu chite buddher Lakshanam vriddhita pritak Samshayaha Doubt Ataha Then Viparyasaha Misapprehension, nischayaha, correct apprehension, smritihi, memory, eva, also, cha, and swapaha, sleep, iti, thus, uchite, are said, buddhahe, of intelligence, lakshanam, characteristics, vrittitaha, by their functions, pritak, different. Srila Prabhupada's translation in purport. Doubt, misapprehension, correct apprehension. So here apprehension doesn't mean fear. It means being able to figure out what something is. So I apprehend something. I can figure it out. I capture it. Like you apprehend a criminal, you capture them. So to be able to understand something means like comprehension. So doubt, misapprehension, correct apprehension, memory, and sleep, as determined by their different functions, are said to be the distinct characteristics of intelligence. Purport. Doubt is one of the important functions of intelligence. Blind acceptance of something does not give evidence of intelligence. Therefore, the word samshaya is very important. In order to cultivate intelligence, one should be doubtful in the beginning. But doubting is not very favorable when information is received from the proper source. In Bhagavad Gita, the Lord says that doubting the words of the authority is the cause of destruction. As described in the Patanjali Yoga system, pramana viparyaya vikalpa nidra smritayaha. By intelligence only, one can understand things as they are. By intelligence only can one understand whether or not he is the body. The study to determine whether one's identity is spiritual or material begins in doubt. When one is able to analyze his actual position, the false identification with the body is detected. This is viparyasa. When false identification is detected, then real identification can be understood. Real identification is described here as nishchayaha, or proved experiential knowledge. Experimental knowledge. This experimental knowledge can be achieved when one has understood the false knowledge. By experimental or proved knowledge, one can understand that he is not the body, but spirit soul. Smriti means memory, and swapa means sleep. Sleep is also necessary to keep the intelligence in working order. If there is no sleep, the brain cannot work nicely. In Bhagavad Gita, it is especially mentioned that a person who regulates eating, sleeping, and other necessities of the body in the proper proportion become very successful in the yoga process. These are some of the aspects of the analytical study of intelligence as described in both the Patanjali Yoga system and the Shankar philosophical system of Kapila Dev in Srimad Bhagavatam. Samshayo ta viparyaso nichchaya svacha eva cha svapa ichyuchate buddhir lakshanam vritta pritak. Doubt, misapprehension, correct apprehension, memory, and sleep, as determined by their different functions, are said to be distinct characteristics of intelligence. So one of the, I think, one of the most wonderful things about the Vedas and the Vedic philosophy and the Bhagavatam is that not only does it give us understanding of the transcendence, but as explained in the Ishopanishad, we understand both the material and spiritual side by side, the temporary and the eternal, the phenomenal and the noumenal. So why do we have to understand the material? We have to understand the material because we're using it. Yeah? We're trying to get to our destination. So just like yesterday, one devotee picked me up from the airport, but she picked me up using someone else's car that she had never driven before. So she wasn't quite sure how to use it. What buttons do what? And it's the kind of car that when you stop for a red light, the engine appears to stop. Yeah? You've been in those kind of cars where the idle speed goes down to imperceptible? And so it appears that the car has turned off. And so if you don't know how to use the car, you may panic and think, oh my God, my car has turned off. Now what do I do? Right? Yes? I'm sure we've all driven someone else's car sometimes and like, well, wait a minute, what do I do? How do I work it? It's a different kind of car. Things are in the other place. What's really hard is if you go to one of the countries where they drive on the other side of the road. It wasn't so much driving on the other side of the road. It was having the steering wheel on the other side of the car. That was really, really hard. It was really hard because I have a sense from the time I was, I guess, 16, 17, of how far the car extends to my right. I can like feel the car as an extension of my body. But I don't have any sense as to how far the car extends to my left when the steering wheel is on the right. And so, thank God it was an old junky car I was driving. I knocked off the mirror on the left side. And several times I scraped the rim of the tire on the left side against the curb because I didn't know how do I work a car on the right. And I can drive a manual stick shift with my moving the gears shift with my right hand, and I've never tried to do it moving it with my left hand. I think that would take some getting used to, huh? It would take a different kind of muscle memory. And I almost died driving one of those cars in London because you know how here we can make a right on red because you only have to look one way to turn right, yeah? But if you're going to turn left, you have to look both ways. Well, you know, in the UK it's reversed. You can easily turn left, but you can't so easily turn right. And there I was turning right, and I only looked one way. Bad, bad decision. So thankfully the other car didn't hit me, but I'm sure the driver thought, stupid American. Right? So after that, I just thought, I'm just going to look every way, every time that I turn, because I'm not going to try to remember it. So the point is, if you want to go someplace, you have to know how the machine you're in is working. Yeah? Yes? If you don't know how to work your machine, then you may crash, or you may stall, or you may break off the mirror or something like that. So we have this material intelligence. How does it work? What is it? What does it do? It's like you have a knob in your car. What does it do? What's its function? So here we're told what are the functions of intelligence. And this is particularly interesting because as an educator, so I gave many, many children intelligence tests. Yes, I'm sure most of us have taken an intelligence test, the Stanford-Binet IQ test, and you end up with some number, right? The number 100 is average, and then there's kind of a range from like 95 to 105, that's average, and then Einstein had 160, and I know someone who has 189, and I know someone who has a 57. So, you know, there's a range of intelligence, and there's a lot of debate as to what the IQ test measures and how culturally specific it is. Yeah, you've heard these debates? Right? So the Bhagavatam is measuring intelligence a little differently than just an IQ test. And it's telling us what are the functions of the intelligence. So everybody would like to be intelligent, yeah? Right? Nobody wants to be foolish, right? Anybody here want to be foolish? No? There was a devotee who wrote a letter to Srila Prabhupada. This is one of those stories that you just like, it couldn't be a true story, but wrote a letter to Srila Prabhupada and signed it, "Always remaining your foolish servant." No! That's not pleasing. We want to become an intelligent servant. Obviously, we should always feel that our guru is more intelligent than us, but we should try to become an intelligent servant. So who remembers the first thing, without looking, the first function of the intelligence? Yes?
Doubt.
And Prabhupada says two apparently contradictory things in this first paragraph where he talks about doubt. What are the apparently two contradictory things? Without looking. Yes?
He says that in the beginning, one has to have doubt. That's where intelligence comes from.
Yes.
But then he also says that if one is then hearing from the authority, then doubt, the doubting propensity will be an obstacle.
Yeah, he doesn't say an obstacle. He said it will be the cause of
destruction.
And it's interesting, in the first sentence he says, blind acceptance of something does not give evidence of intelligence. Does anyone know in Bhagavad Gita 4:34 what Srila Prabhupada says about blind following? He says blind following is
condemned.
So Prabhupada says blind following is condemned, and here he says that doubting the words of an authority is the cause of destruction. Do those seem like kind of mutually contradictory statements? Apparently so, yes. So let's see if we can kind of tease this out a little bit. One of the things I'm working on with the Shastric Advisory Council is systems for how to understand the statements of Guru, Sadhu, and Shastra, which in Western parlance is called hermeneutics. And we're working out a system for this, which once the GBC approves, we'll be able to bring out training to all the devotees. And these are the kind of statements, especially, I mean, to understand any statement from Guru, Sadhu, Shastra, but these are particularly the kind of statements that we kind of scratch our head about and say, well, if I doubt, I'll be destroyed, and if I don't doubt, I'll be condemned. So I'm not quite sure what I'm supposed to do. Now, here there's some bit of a hint in that doubt is useful in the beginning. In fact, it is very important in the beginning. It says it should be. We have the word should. One should be doubtful in the beginning. And we have the time when doubt is not good, where we're getting information from the proper source. So what do you think we're supposed to be doubtful about in the beginning, and what in the world do we mean by beginning? Yes? I can also repeat things.
One thing that comes to mind is doubtful or discerning about our sources of information and knowledge about spiritual life.
Okay, so that's a very logical and reasonable and, shall we say, intelligent conclusion. Because Srila Prabhupada's saying that we shouldn't be doubtful when we hear from the proper source. So it's a very reasonable understanding that what we're supposed to have doubt about in the beginning is who's a proper source. And in fact, such a conception is also verified in many other places in Shastra, that what are we supposed to do before we accept a guru? We're supposed to test the guru. The guru is supposed to test us as well. How long are we supposed to test a guru? Minimal. A year. Now, technically, in Vedic times, that was done in geographical proximity. So you would, not necessarily that you moved into the guru's house, but that you lived in the same general area, and you could observe your spiritual master, your potential spiritual master, for at least a year. And you were supposed to, in that year, be bringing up your doubts, observing the guru's behavior, especially listening to the guru's word, because we can tell authority more by hearing than by seeing. There's a a movie that I used to show when I taught sociology of religion at Bhaktivedanta College in Belgium. And it was about this Indian man who had been born and raised in America, who decided to do his own sociological experiment. Now, if he had done this as part of any kind of an institution, he would immediately have been rejected. His experiment would have been rejected as unethical. So it was a highly unethical sociological experiment. He just made it up himself. So he decided to pretend to be a guru. So he went to India and he sat at the feet of his grandmother and really listened to her accent. So he was physically Indian, but he had a New York accent naturally. So he learned to imitate his grandmother's Indian accent, and he grew a long beard, and he put on saffron robes, and he carried a danda with a symbol on the top that he had made up, you know, some sort of mystic symbol that he had just concocted. And he came to America. I think he came to around this part of the country, in fact. And he got a website made up. He hired some people to make a website and make propaganda that he was some yoga teacher from India teaching a new kind of yoga, which he had made up. He had made up all the practices. He'd made up the philosophy. And he got speaking engagements in yoga clubs where he would teach people his kind of yoga. And after a while, he got about 12 disciples. And he would tell them where he was from. I mean, he just made up everything. He made up his disciplic succession. He made up his residence in India, and you know, he was working with all these people. And what happened was that after a while he started to really care about these people he was helping, and then he didn't know what to do, and he found that he was able to help people just by listening to them. You know, sometimes you just have someone to listen to you, it can be helpful, isn't it? Doesn't really matter who it is. Sometimes people do that on social media, isn't it? They use social media for their therapy. You ever seen people do that? Instead of talking to a therapist, they just dump things on their Facebook page. And then they feel better. Right? So he felt that he should reveal how he was deceptive, but he didn't know how to do it. He just didn't know how to do it because he felt these people had really come to trust him. That wasn't his original intention. Anyway, so he was such a coward, I have to say, that instead of going back there, he just made a video and sent a video to his disciples telling them how he had been a fraud and how he was a fraud from the beginning. You know, eventually he did go out and meet some of them, and some of them did forgive him, but some of them didn't. Some of them were obviously very furious with him. And it's a heavy, heavy, heavy movie. It's a really heavy movie. You know, it was actually quite disturbing to watch this movie and to see how easy it is for us to be fooled. I mean, that was how easy it is for us to be fooled and how easy it is for somebody to decide that they want to deceive people. You know, and of course this goes on not only among people who are interested in Hinduism, it goes on among, you know, there's plenty of fake Christian preachers, yes? Just turn on the TV on a Sunday morning. And there's the guys who say, well, you can tell who's a real Christian by who's rich. And I'm rich. I paid for a jet with $600 million cash. So that proves that I'm a real Christian. And if you want to be a real Christian and be rich like me, send me all your money. And I'm not making that up. I actually saw a clip of one of these fake preachers who said exactly that. So there's all sorts of charlatans. So therefore, one has to be doubtful. And not only are there charlatans in the name of religion, but there are charlatans in the name of science. In general, the world is full of charlatans. Just like we were growing up, and we were told that if you want to be happy, then you get good grades in school, and you go to a prestigious university where you earn good grades there, and you get a high status job, and you get a nice house, and a fancy car, and a flat screen TV in every room, and an attractive spouse, and intelligent children, and a dog, and then you're going to be happy. Right? Weren't we all told that? Does everybody know that that's false? Like, everybody knows that, right? If you just go to the guy in the street and says, if someone does that, are they guaranteed to be happy? Anybody will tell you no, isn't it? Correct? Just go interview people at Walmart. Yeah, I'd have a little survey. Does everybody who graduate from Harvard with a high-status job and make a lot of money and have a beautiful wife, beautiful husband, and a flat-screen TV in every room and a dog, are they all happy? They'll go, of course not. So it's a fake. But even though people know it's false, they still go for it. Isn't that strange? Or, you know, scientists will say, we can only perceive 5% of the matter in the universe, but we're still going to tell you what everything's all about. You know, we can only perceive 5% of the matter in the universe. That's what we think. We don't even know that for sure. I mean, if you can't perceive 95%, how can you be sure what you're not perceiving? We don't really even know what we don't know. But still, we're going to tell you how the universe began and what's the truth of everything and how you should live your life and who you are. Yes? Is that what they say? And it was very interesting that, you know, as an undergraduate, the scientists are all correct. As a master's student, the scientists are all correct. I got up to the PhD level, and then we had a course on the philosophy of science, philosophy of research. And the first thing that they tell us is empirical science can't tell you anything true ever. It's the first thing they taught us. Just, oh, by the way, science can only tell you if something's false. Or they can tell you, as far as we know right now, it's not false. But it can never tell you it's true. Because you never know what you don't know. There may be evidence you don't know about. You understand what I'm saying? And there's many other reasons which I don't have time to get into today. So one should have doubt. One should have some doubt. If someone says, I know the truth, and I can tell you the truth, and I know how to be happy, and I can tell you how to be happy, and I know who you are, and I know what is the purpose of life, and I know how you can achieve it, one should be very doubtful. Because frankly, in the Kali Yuga, the vast majority of people giving us this sort of assurance are cheating. Many of them know they're cheating. Many of them don't even know they're cheating. They're cheating themselves. So there should be a lot of doubt. And if we don't have doubt, we're fools. Right? And we look around us in the world. How many people are following leaders foolishly? It's everywhere, correct? I mean, look at any... If we could pick any area of life. We could pick, you know, physical health, environmental concerns. There's so many things. And so many people are just cheating. So yes, the main thing we want to doubt is who's the right source. We want to get the right source. Now once we get the right source, then continuing to doubt that source is going to be a problem. Now, then you can't progress. So if I want to learn how to play the violin and I find somebody that I'm convinced is going to be able to teach me how to play the violin, and then I never listen to that person's instructions, or I'm always second-guessing them. Like I used to say to my Gurukul students, they'd come up to my desk and argue with me, and I'd say, do you want to argue, or do you want to know? If you just want to argue, I'm not really interested. If you're asking me a question because you want to know, then I'll discuss it with you. And so many times I have people asking me for advice that they just simply want to, they want to have me certify what they've already decided as correct. I run into that all the time. They apparently are asking my advice, but they're not really. They already have their opinion, they already know what they want to do, and they want to be able to say, well, Urmila said I should do it. You know, or people who ask your advice just so they can add it to the list of advice that they've gotten. I mean, that's okay if they're upfront about that in the first place. Okay, I'm advice collecting. You know, collecting from 100 people and I'm going to put it together and then decide what I want to do. It's okay if they're upfront. But it's very, very disturbing when someone comes and says, I really want to hear what you have to say and I'm going to do whatever you say, and then they don't when you tell them something that they didn't want to hear. You're just like, why are you wasting my time? And then you're not really inclined to help them in the future. Have you all had this experience? As somebody comes and asks you for advice, and you think they actually want to know what you think, and you tell them what you think, which is not what they had in mind, and they simply ignore you or criticize you, and then you're like, I'm not going to help them out next time. Now, does that mean that when we hear from authorities, when we hear from a proper source, that we should just blindly accept what we hear from the proper source? Aha, tricky question. Yes. In the back.
Well, I would say no, because I want to understand it first. So I can
okay. It. Okay, very good. Very good. Therefore, what does Krishna say? Tad vidhi pranipatena parikshanti tekenam ganinas tad vidarshana prashna. One should ask questions. Who was very disturbed that his student didn't ask any questions? Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya. He said, I don't know if you understand or not. You're just sitting here, you know, blank face for a week. So we're supposed to ask questions. Can we ask challenging questions? Is that allowed? Or will we be destroyed?
What is challenging?
Okay. Can we ask a question where we express some doubt in the instruction that we've received from our bona fide authority?
Yes.
Yes. Evidence.
We should.
Hmm?
We should.
We should. Can you give me some shastric evidence? I agree. Can you give me some shastric evidence?
Arjuna.
Arjuna. Specific. Someone give me some specific evidence from Arjuna.
Chapter 6,
okay. Doesn't seem practical. Arjuna really has a lot of doubts about in chapter 6. He says, this system of yoga seems impractical to me.
Unendurable
and impractical. And then he asks the question, what will happen if I fail? He said, it seems I'm going to try this, I'm going to fail, and I'll have nothing. And what happens when people try this and fail? It seems that they lose out materially and spiritually. Now, by the way, if you understand why Krishna spoke chapter 6, one of the reasons, of course, then you can understand that this was Krishna's plan. Because Arjuna had been bugging Krishna, you know, I want to just quit fighting, and I just want to go beg and give everything up and renounce everything and just practice buddhi yoga, which is interesting here about buddhi. Just practice the yoga of intelligence. And so, you know, Krishna's trying to convince him that he can practice buddhi yoga while fighting, and Arjuna just doesn't get it. So then finally Krishna says, okay, fine. If you want to leave the battlefield, and you want to just beg, and you want to just be a mendicant, here's how you do it. Go to the, you know, go to a sacred place, sit on a deerskin, look at your nose, don't have anything to do with Draupadi and Subhadra anymore. Just eat the fruits and roots in the forest. Chant Omkara. Put the life air in your heart. Put your mind in your heart, life air in between your eyebrows. And move your life air to the top of your head. Wherever the mind wanders, bring it back. And then Arjuna says, forget it. I'm not doing that. That's a very good preaching technique, by the way. If somebody really insists that they want to do something that you know is not good for them, one of the ways you can do it is say, okay, fine. Is that what you want to do? Okay, well, this is what's involved with it. You know, this is what's going to be involved. And if you want to do it, that's what it is. And then the person might go, oops. So that's kind of what Arjuna would do. Oops, that doesn't sound very practical. What other examples with Arjuna? Some other examples. With Arjuna. When he questioned what Krishna was telling him. Yeah?
I forget the chapter off the top of my head, but when Krishna says he instructed this wisdom...
Yes, that's chapter 4. So Krishna says he instructed this to the sun god, and Arjuna's like, well, wait a minute, we're the same age. How did you instruct this to the sun god millions of years ago? What are you talking about? Yeah. Okay, some more? Yes?
Chapter 8. Prabhupada says in the report there, those questions that Arjuna asked at the beginning are the nature of doubt.
Oh, the nature of doubt. Good. Arjuna asked a whole list of questions at the beginning of chapter 8. And And had he already accepted Krishna as a bona fide source of knowledge?
Yes.
When did he do that? What chapter? In what chapter did Arjuna say, I surrender to you, you're a bona fide source of knowledge? In 10 he says, now I accept everything that you said. But he, before that, he said, I accept you as my authority.
Chapter 2.
He said, I accept you as my guru, I become your disciple. And here in chapter 8 he's giving all these doubts. Chapter 6 he's giving all these doubts. It's not until chapter 10 that he says, yes, I accept that you're the authority. Interesting, isn't it? Where else? End of chapter 4, Arjuna says, I don't understand your equivocal instructions. You seem to be giving me opposite things. You know, why are you engaging me in this ghastly warfare if you think intelligence is better than fruit of work?
Chapter 3.
Yes, okay. You want to find it?
Is
better than fruit of work.
My intelligence is bewildered by your equivocal instructions.
And he also says, why are you engaging me in this abominable activity of fighting? And Arjuna keeps asking the same question, basically, in different ways. We have an instance in the Bhagavatam. Anyone think of an instance in the Bhagavatam? Yes? Yes, we'll take it. Yes? Dhruva Maharaj is an interesting example where he says, I can't follow your instructions. He said, of course he does say to Narada, these are very good instructions, but they're not suitable for me. You're not being individual in how you're giving your instructions, which is a way of criticizing a teacher, by the way. Saying, you know, these instructions were for the wrong person. Of course, it's very interesting because later Dhruva laments that he didn't follow Narada's instructions. But one has to think about what would have happened if he had followed Narada's instructions, which was to go back home and wait until he had calmed down and he wasn't so angry and vengeful anymore. So that's a very deep discussion. Other example from the Bhagavatam, yeah.
Would one example be when
Yudhishthira
doesn't want to become king?
Oh, that's very interesting. When Yudhishthira doesn't want to become the king, when he feels he fought for nothing, even after fighting, even after everything, he's like, I don't want to become the king from this fight. Okay. Yes?
Pali Maharaj to Sukracharya.
Pali Maharaj to Sukracharya. Yes, okay. Yes?
Pali Maharaj preached at the beginning of chapter 6.
Yes.
He tested and he challenges.
He says, yeah, he says this idea that prayaschitta is the proper and the ultimate cure for sinful activity doesn't make sense to me. Yes. So we see, although Srila Prabhupada's saying here, doubting the words of the authority is the cause of destruction, it doesn't mean that even after accepting an authority that you just become a robot. We're never supposed to lose our intelligence. So the kind of doubt that leads to destruction after accepting an authority is where we're thinking that we know better than the authority and we're just throwing them out. We're using them like, as Prabhupada said, a pet. Keeping a guru as a pet. Yes, 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 I have a guru who just simply stamps with approval whatever I want to do. Yeah. And that's not the way to keep a guru. You know, who blesses my house or something. I want my guru to come to my house so they'll bless my house. But I don't want to follow their instructions. But we have to understand the instructions of the guru. We have to know how to apply them. And we have to follow the guru authentically. To follow the guru blindly is actually also condemned. We have to follow intelligently and authentically. And sometimes that means saying to our guru, I'm sorry, I can't follow this. I can't do this. This system of yoga you're giving me, it doesn't seem practical. It doesn't seem like something I can do. I'm not suited for that. Right? Tamal Krishna Maharaj did that with Srila Prabhupada. Tamal Krishna Maharaj was GBC of India, and he said to Prabhupada, I don't like being GBC of India. I can't deal with the Indians. You know, Tamal Krishna Maharaj's personality was kind of opposite to the general mood in India. He had the, you know, get it done yesterday perfectly without any problem. And the mood in India is, you know, it's coming. Be patient. Wish it. And it will have so many problems that you just tolerate. So it was an incompatible situation. And Tamal Krishnamurti, he was very heavy with Prabhupada. He said, I am not staying in India anymore. I want to preach in America. I want to make devotees in America. And Prabhupada finally said, yeah, okay, you do that. You know, or something where we don't understand. Prabhupada, I don't understand this. Okay, then we're looking at next item, which is apprehension, correct apprehension, misapprehension. And here apprehension again means to kind of to grasp, to understand things, to comprehend things. Another word that's used is discrimination. Now, Prabhupada used that in the previous purport, discriminating power. When I was just using this word discrimination at the Gurukul in Dallas, someone of the high school boys said, isn't discrimination bad? Right? Because we have this idea. I said, well, that depends what you're using as the basis for your discrimination. If you say, you know, it's racial discrimination, that's bad, because it means that you're deciding what's good or bad based on a superficial characteristic. But to be able to decide what's good and bad and what's right and wrong based on pertinent characteristics is a sign of intelligence. In education, we have what we call levels of Bloom's taxonomy, which means levels of understanding something. And the first level is just being able to repeat the facts without knowing what you're saying. Like I remember when I was in first grade and they were trying to teach us place value. So we were repeating, 72 is 7 tens and 2 ones, 36 is 6 tens and 3 tens and 6 ones. And we were repeating it like robots. And I thought, this is stupid, I can repeat this. But I didn't know what I was saying. And one night when I was going to sleep at home, I was thinking, 36 is 3 tens and... Oh, 36 is 3 tens and 6 ones. So I went from information to understanding. So the first level is information, the next level is understanding. The next level is application. You can take what you've learned and you can apply it. Then the next level is analyzing. You can take something and break it up into its component parts. The next level is synthesizing. You can take things and you can put it together in new ways. And the final level is evaluating. You can say what's good or what's bad in all different categories and for different purposes. So here we're talking about being able to evaluate something, to know what's good and what's bad, what's true and what's false. And it's interesting that intelligence is in the mode of passion, which we'll talk about more tomorrow. But this ability to know what's good and what's bad, what's true and what's false, is given in the Bhagavad Gita as a symptom of the mode of goodness. To be able to know what to do, what not to do, what's binding, what's liberating, what's good, what's bad. In the mode of passion, you get it mixed up. Some things you get right, some things you don't. In the mode of ignorance, it's reversed. You think what's bad is good and what's good is bad. And here Srila Prabhupada is giving as an example of the use of intelligence in discriminating is figuring out who you are. What am I? Am I the body or am I not the body? Am I the body or am I a spirit? And Prabhupada's saying here, as he says in many places, that this understanding can come through intelligence. We do not need shastra or authority to understand that we are not this body, that we are a spiritual being. And it's interesting that there was at least one conversation when Prabhupada asked devotees, how do you start preaching? What's the first thing you do when you preach? And the devotee said, we convince people there's a God. He said, no, your first preaching should be you're not this body, that you're a spiritual being. And I had an interesting experience at Bhaktivedanta Manor in London where this one woman, probably around my age, maybe a little younger, she was saying that she came to the temple all the time, but that she couldn't get her husband to come because he's an atheist. And I said, well, do you think he would talk to me? And she said, yeah, I think he would. So she came with her husband the next weekend. We were sitting out in the garden. And I just talked to him about empirical evidence that we're not the body. I pretty much just focused on out-of-body and near-death experiences. Because I said, you just can't deny them. There's thousands and thousands of recorded experiences, recorded by scientists and medical doctors, of people having out-of-body experiences. Yes? And giving information that they couldn't have given from their body. you know, someone's on the operating table and their brain stops and their heart stops, and there's, you know, 20 minutes before they're alive again. And when they come back to their body, they were floating at the top of the room, and they were talked about, you know, some sticker on the other side of the fan that you could only see from the ceiling. And sometimes they went to other rooms and they talked about what they saw in the other rooms and what they heard in the other rooms. And they gave all kinds of evidence that just wouldn't have been possible if they were within their body, seeing through the eyes of their body and hearing through the ears of their body. And there's enough of these reports that show that we must be something different from the body. They're like really well documented. So I just focused on that. I really didn't talk about practically anything else. And at the end he said, you know, you're right. We must not be the body. And we can talk about subjective experiences, our sense of continuing identity. Even though our body's radically changed, yes? From when we were 2 years old, do we have a radically different body? Do we have radically different mental processes? But most of us can remember something from when we were little children, yeah? So we have some continuing sense of identity. So here is, Prabhupada is talking about experimental knowledge. That one can experiment and use the intelligence to understand whether we're the body or not the body. So this is a use of intelligence. And then Prabhupada talks about memory, which he doesn't discuss that much here. He just simply mentions that memory is a function of intelligence. And then he talks about sleep. So have we all experienced that if we don't have enough sleep, we become stupid? Yes? This particular statement of Prabhupada about sleep having to do with intelligence is something that I remember frequently. If you don't have enough sleep, you're stupid. You know, it's just what it is. The vast majority of our sleep is for the subtle body, not for the gross body. The gross body only needs about 1.5 to 2 hours of sleep a day. And if we think about how much sleep liberated persons get, that's about how much sleep they get, isn't it? Like the Goswamis were sleeping 1.5, 2 hours, probably slept about 3 hours. Because they only needed to sleep for their gross body. They didn't need to sleep for their subtle body. Why do liberated persons not need to sleep for the subtle body?
So I don't have any evidence of this conclusion, but I kind of surmise that because the pure devotee is always with the super soul, they're always with Krishna. Therefore, the sense of being refreshed that comes from that is actually nourishing, and therefore they require less sleep.
That's a lovely conclusion. Another conclusion would be that the subtle body dissolves. Or the real source of our entanglement in this world is the subtle body, not the gross body. If it was the gross body, then all you'd have to do to get liberated would be commit suicide. It doesn't work very well. Like, please don't try it. It really doesn't work very well. You'll just have to go through whatever suffering you're going through already, plus about 1,000 times more, so it doesn't work. But it's the subtle body that's our problem. And a liberated person doesn't have a material subtle body. They're working just on the spiritual level, so they don't need to give the subtle body sleep. Fascinating, isn't it? Yeah? But most of what happens during sleep is the subtle body is functioning. There's cleaning and sorting. Just like in your house, if you never clean your house. Or like I visit a family sometimes as I travel around the world where the man often works at home and he must not be never, but very rarely cleans his desk. And one time when I was there, his wife asked me if I would help clean out the desk. So. There were unopened envelopes that were stamped as 3 years old. You know, this pile of mail on the desk. I mean, it was like, why are you keeping something unopened since, you know, 2010? Huh? So we have to, how do you function? I said, how do you function? How do you get anything done? I said, do you ever forget to pay bills? Oh yeah, sometimes we forget to pay bills. So, you know, if you never go through your stuff, you never sort out your stuff, everything becomes very chaotic, isn't it? It's very hard to function. So sleep is where things get sorted and categorized. Intelligence is cleaning. Yeah? So Prabhupada says, if there's no sleep, the brain cannot work nicely. Some years ago, I was asked to give a presentation in front of ISKCON leaders in Europe, and I tried to do something I'm not very good at, and that was be diplomatic. So instead of just saying, no, I don't want to, which was how I felt, I said, I'm too busy. I said, I'm too busy teaching at the college. I said, I have classes Monday through Friday. So then the next thing I knew in my inbox, there was a ticket leaving Friday night at 9 o'clock at night and returning, leaving Monday from the meeting at 6 o'clock in the morning. And I'm like, oh, that wasn't quite what I had intended. So, you know, I left at 9 o'clock at night. By the time we got to the location, which was kind of a remote location, it was 2 o'clock in the morning of the day that I was supposed to give the presentation. And they gave me a room to stay in right across from the temple room. So you can imagine how much sleep that I got. I was really trying. I thought, okay, somehow right after they finish the Singha prayers, Tulsi prayer, I'll fall back to sleep. And then the devotees were enjoying walking and chanting right outside my window. So I was like, okay, this is useless. And so I really had, practically speaking, no sleep, and I was in front of all the leaders of ISKCON Europe, and I was presenting a very difficult and controversial presentation, which is why I really should have said no, because I really didn't want to give that presentation. And so after, I engaged everybody in an interactive activity in the first 5 minutes, and the results of that interactive activity were very disturbing to me. I was really, really upset with what people came back with. But I thought, I've had no sleep, and so I must just, if I say anything at all, I'm going to end up offending people. I thought, better not to say anything. So I was just quiet, remembering this purport, that when you haven't had enough sleep, be quiet. You know? What I really wanted to say is, oh my God, you're actually saying that? That's outrageous. That's terrible. How can you say anything like that? But I didn't. I was just quiet. And that's why I was quiet. Of course, I did get into trouble anyway. The room was set up so I had no place to sit while I was presenting, and I was too exhausted to stand for the 3 hours of my presentation. So I sat on the table, and someone took a photograph of me sitting on the table and circulated it all over the internet and said that I violated etiquette by sitting on a table. And it's one of the things I've been most criticized for in the Hare Krishna. Seriously, like really, no joke. So the bottom line is, make sure you have enough sleep if you're giving an important presentation to all the leaders in ISKCON. If you're doing anything important, you know, make sure you have enough sleep. And if you don't have enough sleep, don't do things that you may regret. You know, if you've had to do an overnight travel, I've had to do sometimes overnight travel where I miss 2 nights of sleep, where my flight starts at night, and I'm traveling for 36 or 40 hours, so I don't sleep for 2 nights in a row. So if you're in that kind of a situation, don't say much. You know, talk as little as possible. Don't do very much. Don't make any major life decisions. You know, be super, super careful, because you just got to figure, I don't have any intelligence. And anything that I do, I may regret for the rest of my life, like sitting on a table. So... And we have to get enough sleep. You know, in the early days of the movement, people took a statement where Prabhupada said, anyone who sleeps more than 6 hours is in the mode of ignorance. And so people would force themselves to only sleep 6 hours. But if your body needs 7 hours, get 7 hours. If you can function nicely on 4 hours, jai hari bol. You know, if you need seven, take seven. Take whatever you need to function with intelligence. And it's not just for the body. You're also sleeping for the mind. By the way, interesting, people who teach others how to learn a foreign language, one of the methods of teaching people to learn a foreign language, they say you go to the country where you want to learn the language and you shadow a native speaker and you just imitate whatever they say and whatever gestures they do, and you sleep 16 hours a day. And the reason they tell you to sleep 16 hours a day is you're trying to very, very quickly process all this information. They say within 2 weeks you can get basic understanding of a foreign language if you do that. I've never tried it, so I don't know if it works or not. But I just thought it was interesting that as part of their system, you had to sleep 16 hours a day for your brain to process all this information, right, and your intelligence to work. And then Prabhupada's referencing where Krishna says in the 6th chapter of Bhagavad Gita that if you want to be a yogi, you can't eat or sleep too little or too much. There's four things Krishna says there. Eating, sleeping,
recreation.
Working, and recreation. And the word there for recreation is basically the Sanskrit meaning. It's just like pleasure and fun. Also, when I was teaching at Bhaktivedanta College, one of the students brought a movie of these monks in Europe who took vows of silence. So the only time they could speak is when they were praying out loud in a group. But like if they're working in the kitchen together, they couldn't speak. And they weren't, I don't think they were allowed to use sign language either. Sign language was developed by monks who took vows of silence, by the way, called following the letter but not the spirit. Anyway, that's another topic. So these monks, I don't think they could even use sign language. So if they worked in the kitchen, they had to just somehow communicate with each other without speech. They each ate in their room alone, and the food was put like under their door like you were in a prison cell. You know, and you eat alone, and then you put the plate back out, and just one of the brothers comes and collects it on a tray. And other than when you were in Mass, you know, and you were praying to God, but you couldn't speak to each other. But one day a week, they would go out of the monastery and play games and talk. They found if they didn't have one day a week where they played some active physical games with each other and talked and laughed, that people would go crazy. They'd lose their intelligence. They had to have some time for recreation. I mean, these were serious monks, guys, you know. It's like they're really serious. All they ever did was meditate and pray and read scripture. And I think they had some business they had to run to keep the monastery going also. I don't know, they made fruit jams or something. They had a garden kitchen. But they understood that they needed some recreation. So you know what happens if you try to force yourself to never have any recreation? Yes, you go a little bonkers. But just like if you've ever tried to force yourself not to sleep, now if you've ever done the full-on ekadasi, no food, no water, no sleep, right, the body will start doing this, right? It happens with the military when they do forced marches. People will, they'll sleep walking. Like while they're marching, they'll sleep. The body will just say, I want to sleep. So what happens if you force yourself not to have any recreation? Your body and mind will steal it. Just like your body will steal sleep if you try to force yourself to be awake too long. So you'll end up trying to do some service and then just spacing out. Not being able to focus. You'll end up finding yourself wasting time on some sort of recreation that doesn't recreate you. Because the purpose of recreation is to recreate you, to rejuvenate you. But you'll end up doing some sort of so-called recreation that doesn't do that. So it's very important for us to find ways of recreation and play that also nourish us spiritually. I think it's one of the most important things that we need to do as devotees, is to find spiritually nourishing forms of play. So we just had some wonderful, I'm going to end here because it's after 9. We just had some wonderful experiences in Dallas with Hari Parshad Prabhu, who unfortunately isn't coming to Denver. But I do suggest that you catch some of his seminars online. If you're on Facebook, there's a lot of them are Facebook Live. And he had these wonderful, the seminar that I attended was about poetry, Sanskrit poetry. And wow, it was a whole hour and a half of pure recreation. It was just pure transcendental recreation. And I don't want to ruin it for you, but if you can find it on Facebook. Of course, being there was a little bit better than seeing it in the video. But we're going through all the fun ways that the acharyas have used poetic ornaments in their poetry. And I mean, we were all like practically rolling on the floor. But it was all completely transcendental, all completely about Krishna and Balaram and Lord Chaitanya and Lord Ramachandra. It was just absolutely wonderful. So I'm going to end now since it's after 9. Yes, am I supposed to end now? But I have questions, so what do I do? Take questions? Am I allowed?
Yes.
Did that other Prabhu who came in, did he have a question?
Yes.
Oh, well, you can go capture him again.
He can hear me.
He can hear me. Come back and ask your question. Yes. Ask him first, because he has to go back to the kitchen.
Thank you.
You look like you're cooking hot things.
I'm cooking hot things. So, was that on the call? He had a question.
Yes.
He said, when dealing with doubt, one may accept an authority figure, but they come to a different conclusion, they have different opinions. So someone might say that, oh, this person is full of doubt, but actually, you know, they're reading Shastra and they're just coming to a different opinion. So how does one deal with that?
How does one deal with authorities who have different opinions from each other, or different opinion from whom?
From yourself and the authority figure.
What happens when yourself and the authority figure has a different opinion? Well, it depends what the different opinion is about. It depends what they're in authority about, and it depends what the different opinion is about. So, first of all, we should take as authority figures people who are actually authorities in the area in which we're leaning on them for authority. We have in our Krishna consciousness movement some people going around teaching seminars on how to raise children who've never raised children, never taught children. They have no biological children. They were never a teacher of children. They've never studied even theoretically how to raise children. And they're going around proclaiming themselves as an authority on how to raise children. So first we should make sure that whoever we're going to as an authority is actually an authority in the area in which we're going to them for authoritative guidance. That sounds so reasonable and logical, but we don't always do that. Oh, this is a senior devotee, so therefore they must be knowledgeable in all areas. That's a bunch of poppycock. Only God is knowledgeable in all areas. You know, there's nobody else is knowledgeable in everything except for God. So first make sure that you're going to the right authority for the right thing. Like my husband asked Srila Prabhupada, what's the best kind of tape recorder? And Prabhupada said, that I do not know. You know, Prabhupada wasn't an authority on tape recorders. He never claimed to be an authority on tape recorders. And then different opinions are a sign of personality. Prabhupada gives different opinions as evidence that we're individual persons. So if we have the right authority for the right topic, then different opinions can be there in terms of different personality, but we don't want to have different opinions in terms of tattva. Now, even having said that, you know, again, it depends. Like the residents of Vaikuntha, many of them think that Vishnu is superior to Krishna, according to Brihad Bhagavatamrita. But then we're getting into very technical things. So if someone's your authority and you have a difference of opinion, discuss your difference of opinion with that person. Just like Dhruva Maharaj did and Arjuna did. I have a different opinion. Or like Sukadeva Goswami and Maharaj Parikshit did. You know, I have a different opinion, and work it out. And if you are working under someone as your authority, then even if you have a difference of opinion, unless you're looking at something that's morally or legally dangerous, it's better to follow your authority and ask Krishna to sort it out. And if you keep having differences of opinion with your authority, then maybe you shouldn't have that person as your authority. It depends. You know, we're talking very broadly here. But if you know, if you're working for some devotional project under some authority and you keep having differences of opinion, then it's probably just not a compatible working situation. Does that make sense to everybody? Like Prabhupada told Jamuna, because she and Dinatarani had moved away and they were living off on their own, and the devotees were complaining they weren't getting devotee association. And Prabhupada said, 2 that are compatible is association, and 200 that are not compatible, nobody will make any advancement. So I've sometimes worked under authorities in ISKCON where we had such deep and repeating differences of opinion about how to do things that I said, this is not compatible. You know, I can't have you as my authority, or someone can't have me as their authority, because the differences of opinion are incompatible over a long period of time. So without having some more information about exactly what the question is, it's hard to answer that. But, you know, it's, at least while you're working under someone, you submit your difference of opinion, and unless you're talking about something that's, you know, morally, ethically, legally harmful, just follow and Krishna will sort it out. Let him sort it out. Otherwise, if everybody disobeys whenever they have a difference of opinion, the whole universe is chaotic. Yes, please. I'm Nidra first, yes.
So you're talking about recreation.
Yes.
How is it this process is simply...
Joyful
and simply recreation. So I was wondering if you could say something about that, because sometimes devotees think, yeah, I'm sure it's really recreation, prasadam or whatever, but maybe they don't sports or whatever it might be. So I was wondering if you could say something about the problem.
Well, it's so individual. Like Prabhupada talks about how we should engage in the processes of bhakti according to our personal taste. He says, like, some people may be more interested in kirtanam, some more interested in shravanam, some more interested in archanam. Now, Prabhupada gave everybody supposed to chant 16 rounds, but some people want to chant 40 rounds or 50 rounds. For other people, 16, like, okay, I'll just chant 16. Some people are happy to see the deity worship. Some people want to do deity worship 8 hours a day. So what's recreation for one person isn't necessarily recreation for another person. Prabhupada said when he had spare time and he wanted to do something for recreation, he would sit down and sing a bhajan. But not everybody is going to feel that singing a bhajan is recreation. We're very, very, very individual. You know, some people might feel that working in a garden is recreation. For other people, working in the garden is work. We're very individual. You know, for some people, sewing is going to be their recreation. For some people, sewing is not recreation. You can't. We have to be careful of Atmavan Manyate Jagat. What's recreation for me has to be recreation for everybody. Like among the Radharani's 8 gopi friends, some of them collect flowers, some of them collect only herbs and not flowers. I mean, I had an experience in Vrindavan. I was going to see a good friend of mine, and I brought her flowers for her own worship. Every time I'd see her, I'd bring her flowers. And after a while, she said, Ermila, this is your thing, not mine. She said, when you give me flowers, I have to take the time decorating with them. I'm like, yeah. She said, but I don't want to do that. She said, I'm happy to offer 1 or 2 flowers. So, you know, what was pleasurable for me in service wasn't pleasurable for her. For her, it was an annoyance. For me, it was an opulence. So, our recreation should be in Krishna's service, but what that is, that's different for different people. We are individuals. And it may be different as we progress in Krishna consciousness, too. What we may do as recreation when we've been chanting Hare Krishna for 1 year, and what we may do as recreation after we've been chanting Hare Krishna for 40 years may be a little different. I mean, I've been having a lot of fun the last few months taking verses and putting the English translation to the same meter as the Sanskrit. So I can sing the Sanskrit and then I can sing the English to the same meter. And I particularly like doing it if I put the English in the same part of the translation that the Sanskrit is, which is extremely difficult to do. It'll often take me a week or two to do it, like a little at a time. Just when I have a little time here and there. But somebody else might say, well, that's incredibly boring. You know, but I like playing with language. It's my toy. My idea of fun is playing with ideas, with concepts, with knowledge, with language. Those are my toys. They've always been my toys. But that's not somebody else's toys. It's not their thing. Somebody else would go, yeah. I mean, when I was a teenager, I used to solve logic puzzles for recreation. But other people are going to go, why would you want to do that? Does that make sense? For somebody, managing a festival is recreation. For me, it's exhausting. I can do it, but then I'm like, okay, now I need 3 days to recover. For other people, that's what they do for a vacation. Okay? Yes?
So, I have a doubt.
Okay, good.
In pursuit of...
Then you must be intelligent.
In pursuit of following your class, I have a doubt. You know, something that you said.
Oh, good.
The
we like that.
To doubt an authority once it's already been established. I think I'm wondering if you can use some more elaboration on that because
probably.
For example, like once the authority has been established, for example, at least in our context of Krishna consciousness, we understand that we're infinitesimal living entities, just like how you began in class to explain that scientists only know 5%.
That they claim that.
At most.
That's their own claims. Yeah. Yes.
So, as you know, completely with our own material body and mind, All we really have to go off of is our own sense perception. And since we've accepted that as a premise for our understanding of reality,
yes,
then pretty much anything in reality that a spiritual authority that we've accepted says, no matter if it lines up with whether we reasonably understand it or not, does not necessarily negate it as being true. Because I might have mixed up the words there. But I think you understand where I'm going with this.
Yes, I can understand. I think I can understand where you're going with this.
And so I can just give one example.
Yeah, yes, sure.
Or maybe two.
Sure.
One is for example, one may say, okay, well, it doesn't make any sense that elephants are holding up the universe. So I'm not going to believe it until I fully understand.
Until I go shake hands with the elephant, or shake trunks with the elephant.
Well, I need to have we need to hash this out, I need to figure it out until we understand it. And, you know, it's like, well, you're not going to, you have to accept the authority, right?
Well, that's an example of something where we have absolutely no way of ascertaining it. It's completely beyond, you know, absolutely, completely beyond our ability to ascertain. I mean, the only way that you could maybe ascertain it is if you had mystic powers and you could subtly transport yourselves to go meet the elephants. But even then, you'd have to have faith in your own power, and you'd have to have faith that what you experience is correct. You know, so that's kind of an example of something where anyone who talks about the ultimate nature of the universe and the ultimate nature of origins, they all give supernatural, far out, inexplicable things that from our experience on Earth doesn't make any sense. Everybody does. I don't care, you know, if they're saying that there was a singularity that was infinitely small and infinitely dense that existed beyond space and time and then exploded and created the planets and the universe. That, to me, is just as far out as elephants holding up the universe. One thing isn't more believable than another. We don't have any experience of that. We have no experience of something infinitely small and infinitely dense beyond space and time that explodes and creates order and planets. We don't experience that. We don't experience matter suddenly becoming alive. In fact, we don't experience, you know, I like Vishaka wrote this once in an article about cooking rice and back to Godhead, that the scientists have not been able to make a grain of rice. And I'm like, oh yeah, it's a seed. It's alive. So, you know, they're telling us that matter can become alive, but nobody's demonstrated it. Not even with intelligence. You know, even thousands of intelligent scientists have been trying to make matter come alive, and they haven't been able to succeed. But yet they're telling us this. So it doesn't matter whether you go to a spiritual source or an empirical source. Whenever you talk about those kind of questions, like what's at the border of the universe and what's the origin of life, you always get a supernatural, weird, far-out answer. I mean, always. There's no one who gives some answer as to the origin and the ultimate existence of the universe who gives you an answer that will make sense with your everyday experience. So I'd say on something like that, first of all, who cares if it's elephants holding up the universe? Is that relevant? Do I need to know whether or not that's true? Does it matter? I'd say that practically speaking, it doesn't matter. It matters whether the origin of the universe is an intelligent being or not. That matters. It matters if everything's done by design or by chance. That matters. But are there elephants? Are there turtles? Are there, you know, is it Atlas? What is it? I have no way of telling what's right or wrong. It's completely beyond me, and it's completely irrelevant to my life. So I think for a question to hinge our following authority on that kind of thing, then we can't follow anybody about anything because we're always going to run into that. So can you give me a better example, something that would be more practical relevance?
Well, it's not necessarily practical, but it's more within one's common reality.
Okay.
Okay, so my friend, his Guru Maharaj was the late Mahavishnu Maharaj.
Okay.
Different from the
Yeah, I know.
From the modern Mahavishnu.
Yeah, the one from Western India, yeah.
Yeah, so he he was being trained by his Guru Maharaj, and at one point he had pointed at the sky and he told his disciple, he said, if I tell you sky is purple, then the sky is purple. You accept it. And he just said, what can he do? So is that off, or, you know, that's the best I can give an example right now.
Well, okay, if you're talking about that, then you're talking about definitions of words. What do we mean by a color? What does that mean? And we understand the meaning of a color is something that can be objectively measured with instruments as far as what light is reflected and what light is not reflected. So that's an objective measurement. And my response to that would be, we're talking about a dictionary definition of a word that has a particular agreed upon meaning. So the only way the sky could be purple would be if you want to change the definition of the word. If you want to give it your own definition of the word. Or if you want to say, I perceive the sky as purple. So I can accept that you perceive the sky as purple. I'm not going to accept that I perceive it as purple because I'm not perceiving it as purple. That would be my response. Judging by the way that people respond in the Shastra to these sort of things. I would say that's not how I perceive it. I can accept that that's how you perceive it. But there we're talking about something that there's an agreed upon dictionary definition. You know, if you want to say this is not a microphone, it's a frog, I'll say, but the dictionary definition, this is a microphone. If you want to put another name on it, that's fine. But that's not the agreed upon definition, which is all arbitrary, but it's still. That would be my response. Yes. By the way, when we do teach our course on hermeneutics, I suggest you take the course. You would find it very interesting. Because we deal specifically with questions like that. It's one of the topics that we deal with, is what do we do when Guru, Sadhu, Shastra appear to contradict our perceivable reality? Generally, the hermeneutic rule, the Vedic hermeneutic rule, is that your perceivable reality should be taken as more authoritative. Just by the way. Elephants holding up the universe is not a perceivable reality, therefore it's not in that category. Yes?
Thank you. Sometimes there is a confusion, doubt, mistrust, falling away from faith. When there seems to be oscillating opinions, on one hand you are hearing one should be conservative. On the other hand, you have other people in positions of leadership and authority saying, well, now we can be liberal. On both sides, they're giving all these logical reasons and explanations. You could sleep, or you could get to sleep more. And sometimes people feel cheated who were in the system before, and they become confused like, well, what do I really believe? You know, is there a balance? Like, all of a sudden, it's because you're getting old and infirm that you have this philosophy you're espousing now? Like, what is the truth, really? What should I follow?
Well, just thinking, when Prabhupada told a devotee to eat less, and that devotee said, Prabhupada, when I came, you told me to eat a lot. And Prabhupada said, did you believe me then? He said, so believe me now. So as far as being liberal or conservative, those are interesting terms. Those are not Shastric terms. And then, you know, you're talking about being liberal or conservative about what, in what circumstances. So, to be conservative about, if you're conservative about everything, you die. And if you're liberal about everything, you have no identity. You've got to be able to both keep your identity and respond to your environment in order to be alive. You have to do both. And Prabhupada says both is required. He uses the word required as far as Krishna consciousness goes. That it's required to keep the core principles and it's required to adapt according to time, place, and circumstance. So the question really becomes, what's a principle that can't be changed and what's a detail that must be changed? And the disagreements between so-called conservatives and so-called liberals are on what's principles and what's details. So conservatives tend to label as principles things that liberals label as details, and liberals label as details things that conservatives label as principles. That's basically what you're looking at. Does that make sense to you? Does it make sense to you? Okay, so you have an identity, yes? You're alive, yeah? And what does it mean that you're alive? It means you have an identity that doesn't change. Your identity doesn't change, correct? Am I correct? Your identity, does that change? Or are you the same person always?
Essentially, I'm the same.
Essentially, you're the same. So you're very conservative about your identity. Do you adapt to the circumstances around you?
Sometimes.
Like right now, you're wearing a sweater. Would you wear a sweater if it was 90 degrees? And socks?
I like the heat.
Is there any heat at which you would take off your sweater?
Yes.
So you adapt. If you didn't adapt, you would die. Yes? If you weren't able to adapt to your surroundings, if you weren't able to change, right now you're sitting, sometimes you stand, sometimes you talk, sometimes you're quiet. If you weren't able to adapt to your surroundings, you would also die. So you have two things that you need in order to be alive. One is a continuing sense of identity, that's conservative. One is to be able to adapt what you're doing according to what's going on, that's liberal. And you need both. If you adapt so much to what's going on that you lose your identity, you would cease to exist. And if you never change how you respond to the environment, you would also cease to exist. So you need both. We need to both keep our identity and to adapt. And if there's different people have different opinions about to what extent we should adapt, that's a healthy situation for a society. It shows that we're all individuals. Even in the spiritual world, there's different groups of gopis with different opinions about how to serve Krishna, and they very strongly disagree with each other. They don't all get along all the time. Not at all. They have very strongly held difference of opinions. And Krishna is pleased with both groups, or millions of groups, actually. So there's room in our Krishna consciousness movement for a large variation of how we present Krishna consciousness. And we should be with people who are compatible with us and not try to force everybody to have our opinion. Different opinions are the sign of personality. Now, if somebody wants us to get a different maha mantra, that's a problem. Or if somebody wants to change the initiation vows to 14 rounds or 30 rounds, or they want to add an initiation vow, that's a problem, in my opinion, anyway. If somebody wants to put Lord Shiva on the central altar, that's a problem. So we have certain things that can't be changed. But Prabhupada says it's required to change things according to time, place, and circumstance. He uses the word required. And Prabhupada's prayer to Bhaktisiddhanta, he says, oldest of all, but a new dress, miracle done, your divine grace. So Prabhupada saw that Bhaktisiddhanta had taken the oldest of all and put it in a new dress. And one of the reasons for parampara, one of the reasons why we don't subscribe to the Ritvik philosophy, is that each generation of teachers has to teach according to the time, place, and circumstance in which they are in. We should know that at this time, young people learn most through YouTube, not books. That's just a fact. And if we don't have preachers on YouTube, we're going to be missing most of the young people of this generation. Because they're not going to read our books. They're going to watch videos. So we need to adapt, but we have to keep our identity. And now we need to eat. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. We could definitely discuss all these points for a year or two.